Reformed and Lutheran are in full communion in Europe and have been, see, for over 20 years. So they are wondering what's taking Americans so long. The recent Meissen Agreement moved the Evangelical Church in Germany, which is Lutheran and Reformed, and the Church of England in the same direction, right? So that's the Episcopal piece. Scandinavian and Baltic Lutherans and British and Irish Anglicans are now considering a common statement which would establish full communion among them. In such a triangle, what should be the relationship among Lutheran, Anglican, and Reformed churches in Europe? Or, if the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America votes in 1997, I apologize, I said 95, it's 97. It's two assemblies from now. For full communion with the U.S. Episcopal Church and the three Reformed churches, that's Presbyterian Church USA, Reformed Church of America, and United Church of Christ, how will U.S. Lutherans, Anglicans, and Reformed relate to each other and their counterparts in Europe? And then the next question is, if communion is established among those three Reformation churches in the North, what effect will their fellowship have in the South among churches born out of Anglican, Lutheran, and Reformed missionary efforts? So you see, it's a fascinating domino effect, but I've said that pattern of if A and B are friends and A and C become friends, do B and C automatically become friends? Okay. If Europeans make this agreement, what does it mean for Lutherans, especially are part of the Lutheran World Federation, which is understood now as a communion of churches? It was redefined at the last assembly, not simply a voluntary association, but a communion of churches. So if Lutherans in Europe are already in communion with Reformed or with Anglicans or with whoever, and Lutherans in the United States or Africa are part of the Lutheran World Federation, what does that mean for them? So also see, it's not in lockstep. But what we have talked about now is that for example, any agreement that the ELCA here in the United States is considering, we do not say we have to have the approval of all the LWF members to do this. But rather, we do promise that any step we are considering, we submit for their consideration, and we are open to hear their response. Ultimately, the decision will be ours, you know, about how we will go forward. But that means even ecumenically, the way we think of ourselves as Lutherans in relationship to other Lutherans around the world is changing. To think of ourselves as part of an international communion is different. It's really different. So, he concludes with a sentence that Mary circled. It's appalling to think of being so historically uninformed that one doesn't know how denominations began. And comments that with Americans, this is often a problem. So that was one of the things I was hoping to address in this. The group we're going to talk about today is, for me personally, one of the most appealing and challenging of Christian witnesses, both at the time of the Reformation and even thereafter. I use two names in the title. Please don't, you can walk right in front. Don't worry. You can't take their footrest, but you certainly can come. The Anabaptists and Baptists are closely related groups, but the Anabaptist is the name given to the movement as it originated on the continent of Europe at the time of the Reformation. Anabaptist, it's a Greek preposition meaning to rebaptize. It was a pejorative title given to them. Those who practiced baptism in this manner did not think they were rebaptizing. They felt that the baptism of an adult, and the age of what qualifies as adult could vary, but it had to be a person capable of making a confession of Christ, experiencing conversion, making confession, and voluntarily taking upon themselves a discipline of living within a community. Since for them those were the hallmarks of what baptism was about, you can understand why the baptizing of an infant made no sense. Right? Now, in the first generation, you can sit down, just get here. The first generation of reformers, everybody was baptized as an infant. You just had your kids done, so to speak, right? So that they would have been baptized. Then, as the reform took shape and they rejected the practice of the community out of which they came, a sign of their entering then into this new discipline was to make public confession and be baptized. Those who rejected their practice called them rebaptizers or Anabaptists. And the practice of rebaptizing had been a capital offense in the Roman Empire since early. This is why it was a handy thing to call them rebaptizers. It made it very clear what you thought should be done to them. that dealt with the old practices of how you dealt with heretics who came back into the community. It's a different thing, but it was still on the books, like any number of laws that just sort of hang around long after they make any sense. So, how does this movement begin? Well, we talked, some of you who were here before, about Ulrich Zwingli in the city of Zurich in Switzerland.
Spell the name.
Yes, Ulrich, U-L-R-I-C-H. Zwingli is Z-W-I-N-G-L-I. He was a German-speaking Swiss, and the movement in his canton really focused, some of you may remember, on the issue of how he understood the Lord's Supper, how he celebrated the Lord's Supper. This was the big disagreement with Roman Catholics and Lutherans. Zwingli argued that the Lord's Supper was a sign, as he put it, a sign of a grace already given. That a person who had experienced conversion then made public confession of his or her faith by joining with the community at the Lord's table. Eating and drinking then became the occasion for sort of rising up to a contemplation of the sacrifice of Christ on the cross and a sort of grateful recommitment to living in the discipline of the community as a Christian. Now, you can see with that understanding of the supper why a certain number of people thought, if that's true of the supper, the same thing should be true of baptism. They ought to be consistent. Zwingli didn't cease to baptize infants, and indeed was always very upset that he was seen as sort of the father of Anabaptism, and was hence quite harsh against them in the territory. But the Anabaptists, you see, their idea of baptism, and this thing is important, it's a critical piece of their community, its identification, its practice, but it means something very different than it does for Lutherans. For Lutherans, what is the point of baptizing a baby? Well, baptism is wholly the act of God. Right? Sacraments are the gracious act of God upon the believer. As Luther said, there is no better evidence of the fact that we are justified by the work of Christ's grace than the fact that God would act to baptize an infant who can do absolutely nothing, either to respond appropriately or to merit it. And those of you having recently had my own baby baptized, I realize that, you know, they are more than likely to do something quite embarrassing at the time of their baptism that you would rather not have on a video cam. You know, so that, and for Luther, this was a sign of God's grace. He takes one, Christ comes to one who is completely unaware, places the mark of the cross upon this child, begins a relationship, and by God's own action, creates the faith that the sacrament will require. Original sin is washed away. A new relationship is established, and one can truly say the child is born again. And then the rest of one's life is lived out of this baptism. Right? For Luther, you can really say there's a way in which life just circles around baptism, And he talks about, indeed, that the grave is the day that the promise of baptism is fulfilled. That when one dies, one is finally put beyond the reach of temptation and sin. The old Adam, as Luther puts it, is drowned for good. And the new Adam can rise up spotless and secure. But baptism then is something we return to every day, he said, right? To drown the old Adam, to and think that the imagery there's not just washing, it's literally drowning the old, and that the new can rise up from the waters of baptism. So that for Luther, the central importance of baptism, again, as an outward sign. What was important about it, it was an objective sign. He said, I can't even remember when I was baptized, but there are witnesses to it. This thing was done to me. It stands as an objective public act, and I can't undo it. I can't doubt it. I can't say, gee, I really wonder if I had faith. That's not the point. It's God's faithfulness. So that time and again, Luther will say when he felt tempted by the devil, his response was to say, but I am baptized. I know whose I am. Now, you can see why he was just appalled at this other understanding of baptism. He had very little theological sensitivity for it. And what I want to say is that it is equally important and central to the identity of an Anabaptist or Baptist believer, but it means something different. And within the kind of worldview they have, it makes perfect sense. And this is one of the problems when you bring the two worldviews together ecumenically to say, are you going to redo my baptism? Did mine count? What's supposed to go on here?
Does this mean they don't believe that it is God active?
No, I don't want to say that. Let me tell you where they think God acts. Just like I said about Zwingli's teaching on the supper. That Zwingli said a person who has experienced the grace of God comes to the supper giving public testimony to this experience of God's grace and making a commitment to live within the community. I mean, Baptists probably talk most vocally about grace of any group in this country. I mean, it's not, they do believe that it's God acting in their lives. But what they don't do, in contrast to Luther's teaching here, is have a necessary connection between the action of God's grace and the sacrament of baptism. So that what happens for the Anabaptists now, may I just clarify this, Baptists hold the same view. The Baptists we know in this country descended from the influence of this teaching in England and settlers who came here. So Baptists are like Anabaptists in this regard. But historically, the only surviving Anabaptist communities that have come down to our day intact are Mennonites and the Hutterites. Those of you may know some of the Hutterite communes are from the Anabaptist movements. Okay? Now, the thing about baptism for them, and the Anabaptists claim that indeed they had a strong experience of God's grace. I mean, it was an experience of conversion. And in fact, they talked about baptism on several levels. One of them, they said, was the baptism of the Holy Spirit. Now think of it, think of a Lutheran liturgy, those of you who are Lutheran, a Roman Catholic liturgy. And when you baptize an infant, you talk precisely about the washing of the water, the action of the Spirit. They're all together in this one act. The Anabaptists would understand this baptism of the Holy Spirit sometimes to be a long-term process that brought the heart to conversion. And when one had this experience of conversion, then one submitted oneself to water baptism. Now, what the water baptism meant was, it's the first time you testified. I mean, you stood publicly and said, I have experienced the grace of Christ. I turn my back to the old way. I join this community. I take upon myself its discipline. to live in discipleship with these other covenanted brothers and sisters. It was a conscious, deliberate act of the will. All the things that Luther said, see, nobody could bring to baptism. And it was based on the experience of grace and faith. That I am ready now to make public testimony. For the first generation of Anabaptists, remember this was no light act, much like the early converts to Christianity in the first generations of the church. These people literally turned their backs on what they knew. And because they were rebaptizing in the eyes of their family and their friends, they are also now subject to penalty. And for them, it could have cost their lives. It was a brave act. It was a real confession, in that sense, to do this. Then for many of the Anabaptist communities, because of the realities in which they lived, the third level of baptism was the baptism of blood, of martyrdom, which they could expect. Some areas of Europe, this was far more serious than others. The closer you were to the Habsburgs, the hotter it got. You know what I mean? And Anabaptists, alas, who sprung up in places like Austria and the southern Tyrol, were real fodder. And they developed a kind of martyr's theology because that's what they needed. Now, one of the results of this then understanding, it brings up two other important pieces of Anabaptist practice. One is discipleship. These were people who emphasized greatly the quality of Christian living in the world. Now you can see where once again we're going to run into tension with a tradition that is very nervous about people thinking they are justified by their works. Luther looked at Anabaptist discipline and said, "It's they're new monks. Same difference, but you know, I mean, it's the same kind of thing. And they have violated the freedom of the gospel by taking upon themselves a kind of yoke of legalism." So he criticized their practice of baptism because he said it makes the person being baptized the chief actor. Now I want to say it does, but that's because they think God has already acted beforehand. That's the point I want to make clear. It's not that they look at baptism as their work, it's their response of an act of grace in their lives. And it's supposed to be a confession, so of course they have to act.
When does the act of grace occur?
Well, this is the thing, is that the person, him or herself, in some ways, has to determine that. They are the ones, then, who will say that they're ready to make a confession and join the community. Yeah, Leanne.
What did they do with people who were either mentally or physically unable to determine, or mentally unable,
yes,
to determine, or physically unable to confess, mm-hmm, their conversion in a public way?
I've not read enough to know whether Anabaptists dealt with that directly. I have asked Baptists about that. Mm-hmm. Because the other issue is, what about children? Children aren't baptized in Baptist traditions. And one of the things they said is that precisely persons who have those incapacities, you see, are not dependent on this process, but indeed, in some sense, see, can be recipients of the grace of God. Children, see, they also don't really think children are under bondage to original sin until they come to an age of accountability. Sin is personal sin, and therefore, but they, I think in this sense, my sense is that they do not limit the power. I mean, God's covenant embraces all of the believers in the community and the children born to the community. And they have a great deal of confidence in that. And then those who are not able to go through this, I assume they are not baptized. But on the other hand, maybe some of you have more experience in Baptist congregations. Now, people told me it depends on the level. A lot of people who aren't going to get the sophisticated theological differences can get up and say, "I believe that Jesus loves me." And that would be a confession. And qualified. That would be what they could offer from their heart. I don't know, can somebody speak more to that? Do I have any? Yeah.
Truthfully, it's an age accountability means that you have come to understanding your age may be 5, your age may be 25.
Yes.
So the period in there is nice, that, you know, not by age 12 or 14, or when we confirm people in Lutheran Church, there's a real wide span. A child who can never understand because of limited capabilities of understanding would never come to the age accountability.
And thus wouldn't be held accountable.
Baptism truly is just a sign. It has not a sacrament. Mm-hmm. Do not have sacraments. It's just a sign showing that I am choosing to follow Jesus.
And that's the thing. You see, say what it's saying is that I, with my capacity, respond in this way to make confession and take upon myself this discipline. So that it doesn't, see, the concern for many people is going, well, what about these unbaptized children? And the Anabaptists have a keen sense, as a covenanted people, that the children born to the community are within the covenant. If they die before they come to an age of accountability, they're within the covenant of God's grace.
So that has really didn't do anything for you.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't do any more for you to take a shower in your shower. I mean, it truly is show that you have within you. But as far as it doing...
It is in some sense done more for the community and the world as a witness and a testimony. Yeah. Yes, please.
My youngest son and his wife go to an interdenominational church, and their children they do not have infant baptism. But the time of their dedication as infants was very, very similar, except they did not have the water and the word, but it was welcome to the family of God.
Yes. And I think this is a piece I often find helpful when I'm teaching or trying to sort these things out. If you step back a minute and just look at religious practice sort of across the spectrum of humanity, there's certain things that we do, that every tradition will do. And one of them is ritually marking the major life passages or life transitions. Two of the biggest ones, of course, are birth and death. But another one is what? It's the passing into adulthood. Initiation rites in some tribal communities, sacred thread ceremonies in Hindu communities, when, in some sense, an individual is understood to stand in his or her own right with responsibilities, accountability, possibilities that they did not have while they yet spoke and saw as a child. Okay. So, one could say that if you look at Baptist and Lutheran communities, we cover those bases in different ways, but we do it. And probably the piece that's intriguing is if you look at the practice of the early church, one of the debates about baptizing infants is that many Baptists feel there's no scriptural warrant for it. It is more or less one of those cases that we say, well, scripture doesn't say don't do it. And when it talks about whole households being baptized, we assume they brought the kiddies. Right? And that if the parents were believing, it was appropriate then to take the children into the community. But the practice in the early generations of the church was adult baptism, and it all happened at once. On the eve of Easter, the Easter Vigil, you were baptized, you were confirmed, right? Sealed with the Spirit, marked with oil, and communed for the first time. Now, what happens? Over time, all the adults are Christian. You know, when the empire becomes Christian, sooner or later you don't have adult converts. What do you have? Where does new membership come from? They're children. And now you have what used to be an all-in-one, it gets divided. You baptize at one point, you confirm or mark with chrismation at another point, you commune at another point, and I think we've been struggling ever since to figure out how to order them and what they should mean. Okay? So what do? We baptize infants. Here is this important passage, right? Not only for the child, but for the family. It's a wonderful book by a Dutch scholar. The book is called Rites of Passage. And he talks about liminal states, as he puts it. You have a situation where things are ordered and balanced. Something happens. The immediate family and the community is thrown into flux. It can be a death, It can be the arrival of a new child. We all know that certainly does throw things into flux. Okay? And then you enter into a period which he calls a liminal state. You're neither betwixt or between. It is, as one of my students put it, doing the limbo for a while. And ritually, what communities have tried to do is find ways to guide those persons in these liminal states through them, bring them out on the other side, and sort of get a new balance structure again, and that for the community as well. It's most keenly articulated at a time of death. Think of the old practices of mourning, when you went into mourning for a year or whatever, right, to make that move. But this is part of what baptism is doing. As a new member into the family of Christ, a new member to this family, right? Now, what's another time we all feel? Is when children come of age. And in earlier, I mean, I think the American human young are among the longest to come of age. That if we were going to match coming of age with confirmation, we'd probably do it at 25. You know? I mean, it just extends in a way that, but there was a time where coming of age was just that. You know, you were ready to go to war, you were ready to bear children, you were ready to have your own household, or whatever. Right? So to mark that passage into adulthood and see how we've shifted now, when is the right time to confirm? You know, when is it going to be meaningful? But that's part of what it's marking. And now into that flux, we've added the fact it used to be, when I grew up, and maybe for many of you, when did you take communion for the first time? Right after you were confirmed. Now we've decided, see, children don't need to wait that long. But it has meant more and more for Lutherans, and I think for every tradition that baptizes infants, confirmation is harder and harder to fit in to the schema. Right? Now, what I'm saying is in the Baptist congregations, as a friend pointed out here, what do they do with a new baby? They dedicate it. The moment doesn't go unmarked.
Not always. That's new in the past 3 years.
Yes, I think it is that recent? I think it is responding in many ways to this same sort of sensed need about what you say about children. Sense of when do they make confession and be baptized, you see? Well, age of accountability. It is that passage into adulthood.
But we have adult and children baptisms too. A lot of times the whole family comes in and there might be a teenager and a child and a baby. They all get, and a parent that all get baptized at the same time.
And as a tradition and all traditions that baptize babies, we really have to think again, because you have to acknowledge when an adult comes for baptism, something was cooking before they got there. Mm-hmm.
But age of accountability is not adulthood. Those are not anywhere to do with each other.
But age of accountability is, in some sense, a passage into a new status in the community.
Age of accountability, those five-year-olds, quite often we feel, have an understanding of salvation, that they are accountable. So it truly depends on the child.
Yes, it depends on the child.
But it's not anywhere near adulthood. Adulthood has nothing to do with...
The average age, at which, at least to the Baptists I've talked to, the average age at which they'll come to be baptized often is quite akin to that. We were baptized at 5. See, I was told that... But I guess then that's a good corrective. Let me say, though, the piece of it is to talk about a person still being of a state where they take a new standing in the community and they are responsible, which are some of the signs of what we think of as being adult. And at least age-wise, in those early generations, it would appear that many of them did make confessions sort of around. But, of course, also, the pattern of when they passed into adulthood socially was structured differently in the 16th century.
Can we talk about the Baptists now in the United States?
Now, Baptists now in the United States, I think, continue. I mean, again, the same important role of baptism as a confession on the part of the person and a commitment to the community and a commitment to a discipline.
Okay, what about testimonials and having people go up to the altar and all the stuff that we think of as Baptist?
Well, I think that's very much a part of what it is to make confession.
Call to discipleship.
And a call to discipleship. And also, these movements were extraordinarily evangelical. in that missionary enterprise right from the beginning, with the Anabaptists on the continent too. These people, at cost of their lives, went out to win converts. So that the willingness to make public testimony. Now, there's a lot that's passed between the 16th century and now in terms of individual understandings and experiences and recordings of piety, but the willingness to bear confession to Christ, I think, has been, and that's what's at the heart of being baptized. Okay. And part of your obligation as a member of that community is to be a missionary. I mean, I think that is, that would be seem a fair way of how they regard it. Mm-hmm. So that you don't, the Anabaptists in their own century, and this was true of Baptists in England, and in some ways still true of Baptists here, they distinguished themselves by their style of life. And they understood that what they were not supposed to do was be a light hidden under a bushel, but they were to stand out to the world as a painful, sometimes, well, usually chastising reminder to the world that its ways were not the ways of God, and that the ways of the world were not the last word. So the Anabaptist communities, another very distinguishing feature of them, was that they were the one group at the Reformation who insisted that a believing community had to sever its connection with the state, with any kind of coercive civil force. Lutherans depended on their princes. The Roman Catholic Church was constantly turning to the monarchs. Henry VIII, you know, as we said, had a firm hand in how the church would be run in England, as did his successors. In Zurich, Zwingli himself used the city council to enact reform. They called the kinds of public meetings that discussed what would be done. And the first Anabaptists actually severed themselves from Zwingli's movement over that issue. Right? That the community of Christians had to be voluntary, it had to be personal commitment. You couldn't say, all right, you're born in Zurich, you're a member of the Zurich Church. You're baptized as a baby, that puts you on the church rolls, and it also enters you into the civil rolls. And that whatever kind of reform was enacted could not depend on the sword. So, then other aspects of those are the hallmarks then was their unwillingness to take oaths. They took the Sermon on the Mount quite literally. That Christ did come, in some sense, as a new lawgiver. That he proclaimed a quality of discipleship that was incumbent on everyone. And if that meant that you had to sever your connections with the world at large to be a faithful disciple, that's what you needed to do. So their ideal was indeed, in some sense, to draw apart into a community unto themselves. And the Hutterites were probably the only group that was really successful at that because they lived in an area where it was tolerated. But those of you who've been near Hutterite communes, that's exactly what they do. They do not, I mean, they live unto themselves. In the area where I grew up, I was in Maryland, but near Pennsylvania, lots and lots of Amish people. And it's still quite interesting to me that the Amish come down and have a big farmer's market in my parents' hometown, which is Annapolis, Maryland. And it's quite a tourist trap now, full of wealthy boaters. And you will go to this market, and it will be full of the typical American inappropriately dressed on any given summer day, sort of cruising around in their tank tops and tube tops and buying summer sausage and everything. And this lineup of people who run this market, and the bonnets, you know, and the beards and the hats, who intermingle in that they sell stuff, but that they just have nothing to do with them. I mean, it's very intriguing to me, especially to watch the children and think, what do you think of these people? You know, with the pump-up Nikes and the boom boxes. I mean, does this interest you? Do you care, you know? One of my professors at seminary in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, had a wife with a severe back problem, and so they had somebody help do the house cleaning because she couldn't lift heavy things, and they had an Amish woman. And he said he will never forget the day of the first moonwalk. And they had the TV, and you're watching this moonwalk, and she just went about her business as if it wasn't happening. just wasn't happening. You know, she was still like adjusting to a vacuum cleaner. Kind of. And so there, this sort of distinguishing of one's life, and a sense that to preserve a kind of purity, you can see why Luther criticized it as seeming like new monkery. You don't, if here's somebody saying you need to serve your neighbor, and these people will leave their neighbor in the lurch to go off and keep pure in their own community. And precisely because they wouldn't take oaths, they wouldn't bear the sword, the civil community was really left in the lurch. They wouldn't be magistrates, they wouldn't be soldiers, they wouldn't, and in a time when people bonded by offering their word, their oath to one another, their unwillingness to do this was very suspicious. Now, let me give you the other side of thinking about this discipleship, and I think this is true of Baptists in this country today. Although, everybody drops their markers differently. This is what I've said is the big danger of defining a community by behaviors. Because you may think one behavior is ungodly, that for me is just sort of a cultural norm. Right? You know, I mean, that this is what we found when people went to Africa and sort of went bananas about polygamy. Right? Or certainly in this country, the consumption of alcoholic beverages is often a dividing line. And certain other gambling, other kinds of behaviors. But the willingness to refrain from those, to sort of offer a vision of discipleship, is seen as the chief calling. And the Anabaptist critique was always, if you are willing to stay in the world and you say you're staying there for the sake of the neighbor, the truth is that sooner or later you're going to be just like the world. You're going to always find a reason to compromise. Right? And that something was far better served, as they said, by drawing apart, by sort of shining as a beacon to remind people of a higher and better way. In terms of a sense of how deeply grace had penetrated life, I think the Anabaptists, in some ways, were the ones who thought it had gone the deepest and farthest. I mean, they talked in terms of recreating paradise on earth. They were agricultural workers. They described their life as tending the garden, carving out a piece and recreating paradise in the midst of the wilderness. And that they were perhaps the most difficult for rulers to deal with, because they weren't rebels. Don't get me, I mean, there were some groups that did get armed and violent, but by and large, we're not talking about people who disobeyed the law, who went out of their way to be rebellious and problematic. They basically thought of themselves as citizens of the heavenly kingdom, and hence their present citizenship was irrelevant. Right? And they really irked other people, right, in this. The communes, the Hutterite communes were over in the East. We know there's some lovely accounts of how this worked. That people would just pack up and go. Now, oftentimes when they did that, they left their children behind or a spouse behind who wasn't interested, so that was socially very disruptive. Right? But we also know that in some of the small communities out of which they came, you know, they'd wake up one day and Hans and Eva and the kiddies weren't there anymore. You know, but they think, well, they may not like it. Not everybody who goes Hutterite likes it. So they kept their property for a while to see if they came back. You know, now there's a certain kind of humane wisdom in this that had it all over the rulers, I think. But the letters that we have from people at those Hutterite communes, some loved it. They really did think they found paradise, and others were bitterly disappointed, which I suppose is always the chance with this vision of discipleship. It isn't always fulfilling. It's not always perfect. I just thought the other day when somebody, they pray for places in the world where you think justice should come. And somebody right away prayed for justice to come to Holden Village. And I thought, I wonder what got to them. Mm-hmm. So that's the way it was for some Hutterites. I mean, this was the dream come true. But people remained people. And they didn't always find it just. As one woman wrote, the wise of the leaders get to wear fancy hats and they eat better food. That's one of my favorite letters. I thought we're all supposed to be equal here. I don't like my hat, you know? But in another way, the Hutterites marked here, they withdrew from the world. They're the fullest expression of Anabaptism. They lived in these communities. They made a mark of evangelical confession, the complete sharing of property. They were communists in that sense. We think it began because of terrible want. You know, sometimes you share because you just have to if everybody's going to survive. But then their vision of Christ's kingdom was one where there is neither his, hers, mine, or thine, but only ours. And Murray talked about Luther's vision of the problem with sin is being turned in on yourself. Well, there's a similarity here with people who believed that the only way you could be really free to love and witness is if you could also let go of having to have things that are mine. And this even went so far as to include their children who were raised in a group setting. They began kindergartens, right? That it was all belonged to the community. This, of course, was a witness not only theologically but socially that was very challenging to many people at the time and not welcome. They were strict pacifists. The Hutterites, who were driven out from one place to another, I say many of them did come to this country, but at the time of the two world wars, their pacifism and their Germanic roots got them in deep trouble. Many of them then fled to Canada and didn't return.
There's a huge bunch of them in Belize. When I was there in November, we flew over their farms. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, still with their wagons and everything, and here's Belize trying to get up to the 21st century around them. It's very interesting.
Yeah. Another place they sought shelter was in Russia, interestingly enough, and were there. There, they were allowed, because one thing, they were often welcome because they were very good agricultural workers. So no matter what the ruler thought of them theologically, he or she was glad to have them developing land. Okay. But in Russia, they were allowed to live in pockets. They never learned Russian. They continued to speak German. But under Catherine the Great, she was beginning to insist that they serve in the military. And then for them, that was persecution, and so they left. But they are an interesting group.
They still speak German in Belize, too.
Yeah. So that question, then, of a distinctive lifestyle, the separation from the coercive power of the state, this role of baptism, but more importantly, how baptism functions in leading you into a life of discipleship that stands out in the world. And the kind of fights in the Reformation period about saved by grace, saved by works, justification, sanctification, you can see where there are bound to be conflicts. In many ways, I look at the Anabaptists in this somewhat akin to Calvin as saying, we get the justification part. Now what do we do with the rest of our lives? What are we justified for? And this critique of the traditions to each other, I think, is a very powerful one. Because Luther's insistence, he said, a magistrate or a soldier doing his or her job well can be saved. Okay. There was almost a twofold ethic. Yes, it would be nice. Christians should live according to the Sermon on the Mount. Luther would agree, but then he'd say, but there are precious few real Christians in the world. Okay. Kind of pulling the rug under and saying, while the Christians are busy forgiving one another and turning the other cheek, the wolves will devour the sheep. Amazing. So his sense of this world is a broken place, your place is in it, struggling, using the law to protect the weak, to defend the innocent, to keep the wolves at bay. And if you need to use the sword to do it, that's what you're called to do. And that's what I'm saying. I think that he still lives in that, really sees us in that betwixt and between time, where the Anabaptists, in some sense, are already moving forward into a time of, you know, when the lion will lie down with the lamb and everybody will get the same hat.
The Anabaptists have a mission. Missionary?
Yes.
The
Hutterites. The Hutterites, I know, and the others, they sent people out regularly. Luther, in fact, he's just so scathing about them, and he calls them Winkelprediger, It's the German term means people who preach in the corners, which meant that the Anabaptists, now the other thing is they didn't have an office of the ministry. They didn't have the same kind of structured ministry. I mean, if you had a moving experience, you could go and preach. So they would show up in these towns and they would preach. And they were very impressive to people. And Luther said, this is my favorite, talk about Catch 22. They shouldn't come and preach unless they notify the pastor first. Well, if what you're doing is a capital offense, you've got to be pretty stupid to sort of say, I'm coming to town, I'd like to speak to your congregation before you take me down to the river and drown me. You know? But that's another reason. See, they were seen as troublemakers and destroying the order of things. And order was very important. Now, when they were executed, very often they were drowned. I mean, it was quite sadistic, but they said, you want to be baptized again? Allow us. They would weight them with bricks and drown them. And one of the things that, in terms of the growth of tolerance as a real virtue in people, came precisely from the fact that many who disagreed with their teaching still felt they did nothing to deserve this, and were impressed by the discipline and the decency of their lives, which is just one way to say works do matter. They do matter to the neighbor. Yes, please.
But why would they drown them? What was the point of that? Because it was ruining the order, but weren't they also Christians?
Well, they drowned them, actually. They drowned them because their unwillingness, they were usually executed on the basis of treason, not heresy.
But were they also Christians? Or?
Oh, yes.
So Christians were killing Christians over basic theology.
Actually, in this case, they were encouraged, yes, they were encouraged to kill them more because of their unwillingness to take oaths of loyalty to the civic body that they were held. I mean, it was seen also that they were treasonous. But I think, frankly, that was kind of an excuse. I mean, there were some groups that went into open rebellion, and I won't get into that because some people have argued, well, just because they baptized people at the age of accountability, does that make them Anabaptists if they weren't pacifists? You know, there's a mixture here, but by and large, we're talking about people who didn't disobey the laws, who lived peaceably within. In fact, one Dutch scholar has done an interesting study. He's gone through all the court records in a certain area where they were taken to trial, and what he can find out. His guess is that the actual number of Anabaptists in any given community was pretty small. And his explanation is one that made a lot of sense to me. When I was in high school, we had a Nazarene church in my town. And I remember, what did Nazarenes mean to us? It meant the people who couldn't go to pep rallies, dances, wear any makeup, or generally come to slumber parties and be scuzzy. You know, we felt sorry for them. And we did, and our urge was not that we had to purge them from our midst. We just sort of thought, boy, I'm glad I'm not a Nazarene. Why would you do that? Now, that was probably the majority reaction. This man argues, and they were very nice. You know, this man argues in the same way that probably most people in a town thought, why would they do that? You know, but if they want to do that, fine. If they want to wear funny clothes, and they don't want to say hello to me because, fine. That they were likely to be more protective rather than really threatened by them. Right. So that that the reaction was, in many ways, out of proportion. But one of the problems is precisely because they were forced underground, it's very hard to know how many of them there really were. And that meant that anybody who got fearful could magnify it. You know, say that they're out there, they're gonna convert your children, you know, they're gonna run off, make them Hutterites, they're gonna, you know, do this, that, or the other thing. We're gonna go to war when the Turk comes and all the Anabaptists are gonna sit down and not help, you know, and that, so the social pieces were not insignificant. In terms of our ecumenical relations, let me say that this is the one group in some ways that Protestants are really accountable to. They're Protestants, if you, that The descendants of these communities are troubled by the persecutions of that period, by the maligning and the cruelty. So it's a piece of our history as we go forward with them. Now, this is on the continent, but remember, the people who come here from England many are influenced by this kind of teaching. And Americans, any American believer in whatever tradition, is very greatly marked by the Anabaptist experience, because what's the hallmark of church life in this country? It's voluntary, it's committed. The state can in no way favor any group, has to protect them all equally. Coercion is not allowed, right? And if you don't like what's going on, what do? You brush the dust off your Birkenstocks and go to church somewhere else, right? We don't burn people at the stake. We don't excommunicate them. We don't try to force belief. The only power that the Anabaptists would use was the power of persuasion. That's why they're strong witnessers. And then within the community, they used the shunning and bans, you know, people who fell out of the discipline, then people just would have nothing to do with them. But if they didn't want to repent and come back, they could leave. You see. They would not then be turned over to the civil authorities to be publicly humiliated and punished. Let me stop there for questions or comments. Is this familiar stuff? You know, yeah, Martin.
In the Lutheran tradition, we're more aligned with the notion that we are simultaneously saint and sinner. The human anthropology for us is that we are broken right down through the middle. And for us, the pure life is not an option. We don't have access to that because the brokenness is inside each of us. When they separated themselves off, then I guess the question is, well, did they have an anthropology different than that? If they didn't, how did they separate themselves into this sort of kingdom on earth? And then the third question is, how did they regulate one another? If they knew sin within this pure community, how did they deal with one another?
I do want to say they clearly did. I mean, any community that sort of builds in a mechanism for repentance and reconciliation, saying that they know it's going to be imperfect. You know, one of the things I've wondered a bit, Martin, about is how introspective. You know what I mean? It's one thing for us to say, I know I never do these things with my whole heart. You know, it's another thing to say, look, you know, this is the discipline of the community. This is what is expected. Sometimes I wonder if these were the people who had a good idea about cognitive dissonance. That frankly, if you were just forced to behave in certain ways, you did it long enough, you begin to think in ways that suited it. and that's not to say that envy and rancor and all the rest weren't there, but I think they did clearly feel that one could do a lot better than they saw the average Lutheran congregation doing. And that one of the ways, I mean, at that time, to help this was precisely to set oneself aside from certain kinds of influences in the world. Christ was their model. In many ways, his role as an example is really more important than it is kind of as an atoning sacrifice. And if you've read, I don't know if some of you have read the work of a current, he's an ethicist, Stanley Hauerwas.
A while now.
Yes, yes. But he really takes up Anabaptist ethic. And part of what he says is how you form people in a story where Christ is sort of Christ's way of living is the main figure. And
is that
so
President Aliens? Is that the one?
Well, there's also the community of character. And so I think part of this thing about being split through the middle is to say there's almost a way where in terms of one's life towards the neighbor, whatever, that could be irrelevant. Do you know what I mean? That That my, I had a student one time, I remember, came to me and was complaining about having to visit this very unpleasant woman in a nursing home. And she was saying, I don't want to go. I hate going there. And I asked her, I said, well, do you go? And she said, well, of course I go. And I said, and do you like sit down by the woman's bedside and say, God, I hate coming to see you. You are really obnoxious. And she said, well, of course not. I said, well, what do you do? And she said, well, I pray with her and I do her laundry. And I said, did it ever stop? I mean, do you think maybe God's will has been done? You know, that it'll be whatever. Maybe you don't like it, but the neighbor was served. Now, I don't really think that's so far, actually, from what Luther would say, but some of the Anabaptists do believe on an extreme level. I mean, there's a range of them, how they react to sin, but there were some who did believe that the children of believers were born without sin. But that's not the mainstream, and that's certainly not what... I mean, Baptists also speak quite fluently about sin as a present reality, as well. So I think they have a mixed view. Does that answer? And within the community, it was this banning and shunning. I mean, it was saying you have to conform to the discipline of this community.